Are you looking to optimize your performance, grow your mind, and change your system? Well, you've come to the right place. I'm Brad Baker.
And I'm Tom Brobeck.
And this is the Bold Base Performance Podcast.
Hello, friends. Welcome to the show. Today we have on Coach Tyler Rathke. Tyler wears multiple hats as a high school head track coach and strength and conditioning coach at William Crispin High School in Missouri. He also serves as a middle school basketball coach. I have no idea when he sleeps, but he presents as a man of principle, passion, and pursuit for greater knowledge. This episode, we talk about off-season basketball training, and he gives you some easy-to-implement neural drills to start using with your athletes today. Check the show notes for more on Tyler and what's going on at Bold Base Performance. Let's continue to grow the mind and change the system. What got you interested in like being a basketball coach? You know, did you play growing up? Did you have a coach that really impacted you? And like, why do you bring that passion to that side of the game?
Yeah, so I played basketball my whole life. Really, I think kind of developed as in sixth grade all the way through high school. Started as a sophomore. It was the first time I got to start varsity basketball. Always was my favorite thing growing up. And then I kind of peaked out. So I was 6'2 in sixth grade and never grew again after that. So, you know, my dad's 6'5, thought I was going to be a big, big post player, 6'6, 6'8, and have a shot at that next level as a post, and never did. So historically, I always wanted to be a basketball player. I don't know that I thought about being a basketball coach, but it was definitely a big part of my life, year-round basketball, year-round soccer. I was a multi-sport athlete. And then what basically happened was I became really good at track, won state championships, and then I was being recruited. And what you're recruited for, you're automatically going to somewhat become interested in, and obviously became my true passion. But coming down from, I coached a year at Cloud County Community College in Kansas, which is in the Jayhawk Conference, as an assistant track coach. And then once I transitioned to the high school level, being where we're at, they like coaches that are in the PE department to coach multiple sports. So I started coaching at the high school. My first year, I coached junior varsity basketball. I don't know that I was ready for that. I think I did as good of a job as I could. We all grow as coaches as we go through those experiences, which is hard to understand when you're that young, gung-ho coach. You think you know it all, but really all the experiences every year that I experience make me different and better. So anyway, I got on the high school staff for 2 years, and we had a transition of head coaches at the varsity level. And I offered up to go down to our middle school, which is a direct feeder middle school. And I felt like I could make a really big impact with what I know and my skill set and my passion at that level. I can be a direct link by being at the high school as a teacher. I can directly link to those, to the high school program coaching staff, seeing what they do, interacting with those kids and training those kids in the off season and in the summers, and then working with the middle school group. So I just create this transition, you know, and communication really is key for where we're at, making sure kids understand what opportunities are available for camps and all that stuff. So yeah, started coaching basketball, been coaching basketball for 6 years, JV, freshman, and now I coach seventh and eighth grade boys at our direct feeder middle school. And we have three teams, an A, B, and a C. Typically have about 70 kids that try out. We cut down, which is the hardest part and the roughest part, cutting 12-year-old kids. This year was a really interesting year with COVID. We had 26 kids try out for our team, not even had to make any cuts. It's been a different year. And again, just more perspective and a different skill set. So adapting to the different skills that those kids need as a coach. You can't just run the same thing that you did the year before with guys that were, we had a really good team last year. And so the whole system has shifted to more fundamental stuff. And so, yeah, basketball is a passion, and I've always done the off season training for our high school. So with the previous staff, they entrusted me because I was teaching strength and conditioning. They gave me the kids in the fall. When we transitioned to the new head coach, I think it took just a little bit. of time, and then he realized what I was doing was good. And it's, again, has changed dramatically over time. But I get the kids each off season in the summer for about 8 weeks, and then I get them in the fall, about a maybe 3 to 4 week break in between summer, and then I come back and I spend another 8 weeks with them before the season. And my role with the high school kids is going to be a viewpoint of skill development without a basketball, because of Mish's policies with specific gym time and a ball, making it specific to the sport, which I think is funny. You can't use the ball. So we do a variety of things, which I'm sure we'll discuss today, kind of in that off-season training. And then really we try to get the basketball guys in my particular strength training class. So I train strength, weight room movements during the day primarily. And then I view the after school or the summertime with that skill development outside of the weight room. So
what aspects of coaching do you need to differ the most when you're working with that seventh and eighth grade population versus an 11th or 12th grader?
So this is interesting. Like I said, with a limited squad that came out this year, I felt like things that traditionally, in my estimation, basketball coaches that really didn't have a clue what they were doing, some of that I've had to do, focusing on literally just basic locomotion and coordination of movement, passing and catching, and how much time we spend on layups with the amount of layups we miss or we're missing, just really basic movement skills and patterns, and then the coordination of multitasking skills and stacking those skills on top of each other. And so from just a purely basketball standpoint, I just take the same, I guess, progression that I would with the other stuff, where simple, increase complexity, and then add some sort of like resistance or load or challenge. And anything I do, that's kind of how I progress it and build it. But I think with these young guys that are not as experienced with the game of basketball, they haven't played. For me, it's really, really dumbed down skill. And then once we master that, we move on. What's really cool about this group, and again, I'm talking about a specific group, I need to stop, but this has become the most complex group that we've ever had. I don't know if it's because of the lack of playing experience or it's because of the character of the individuals. All are good students. We lost nobody academically, all come to practice. Like, we have perfect attendance. It's just a really solid group. We've gotten to a really advanced place where in the past kids that have played, I'll introduce a concept and it'll take weeks or months, or that never hits home. We can introduce something on the fly. This has been awesome. We can introduce something on the fly out of a basic drill at this point in our season, and we'll pick it up through the one repetition. Now there's a few outliers in our group of eight. We have eight on our A team. But it's just been really cool. Their intent and their focus on what I'm saying has been really great. And so it's been fun. We haven't won a lot of games, but man, we execute what we do. We just got done playing a team for the third time in 4 games, and we completely shifted everything we did. And I would have never been able to do that with the average group at that age. And we came out and we executed at a really high level and gave ourselves a chance for a half, and then just got our socks blown off in the second half. But I mean, it's cool. So yeah, basic skills, everything that the high school kid needs and lacks because of the way they've trained growing up or have not trained, the middle schoolers need just maybe more on a slower paced progression. But the basic skills through simple progressions and warming up, I think you can address a lot of those movement qualities and multi-directional concepts in the warm-up. I know a lot of middle school coaches start with a circle stretch, static stretch. I know that occurs. And though that may have its place in some programs, it's not teaching those skills. So where are those coaches teaching it? I just think they neglect it and the kid just can demonstrate what he knows already. I try to teach those movements through the warm-up and then apply them to the game. So
we'll get to that warm-up in a second, but the ability for kids to learn and adapt quickly is just paramount, especially in the sport of basketball, because in a game situation, the other team, they might start pressing, they might go to zone, your point guard might get hurt, and someone who hasn't played point guard has to bring the ball up. You might have foul trouble with your center. You know, there's so many different variables in a high speed back and forth game like basketball that you as a coach, you know, you can adapt, you know how to react, but have you equipped these kids with facing this adversity in like an unforeseeable challenge? And can they adapt to that in the context, not only, you know, week to week, but in the middle of a game? And that's when you're going to see more success. And it sounds like you've set up your kids for success that way.
Yeah, I think another quick thought from a basketball coaching perspective, we have a really great women's basketball coach at our school that had retired in Kansas. He's coming up on his 600th win as a head basketball coach.
Wow.
And what he showed me was, I've always been impressed by the way our girls basketball teams play and execute here. Our girls basketball teams here execute at a higher level than our boys, or had for a very long time. We had a really good boys team 2 years ago that probably could have matched, but we've had really good girls basketball programs. And so talking to Coach Schaefer, he basically breaks down the skill into a small, two person activity. So just let's give a basic example of like defending a cross screen, defending a down screen, defending a flare, defending a curl. So he takes all these actions that you might see from 600 wins, you've seen everything, and he puts his girls in the position to defend or execute those skills, whether it's offensive or defensive. And so he breaks the skill down in a small-sided thing, and then he applies it to the full. And when he has a play sheet of like all these different things that they have to have before they play a game sort of deal. And when you start breaking skills down, same way when you would apply with training, into that small piece and then hopefully applying it to the greater piece, I think that's where you get the carryover. And with the decision-making and the adapting, you teach players to do that by putting them in situations in practice that require that decision to be made quick based on a read or a react to whatever they see. And so breakthrough basketball, I want to say, I'm not great with names sometimes, but really good BDT, basketball decision training. What they do with basketball is what I think I do with movement and skill work without the ball. And with that BDT, basketball decision training, Chris Oliver is his name. I think I try to implement that in practice, again, in a small-sided situation, so that when we get into our offense and the ball goes from one side to the other and there's two players on one side of the court, I go, hey, look, it's just like that 2v2 decision-making that we did. So all they have to do once they get through an action, like let's say dribble handoff from one side to the other, here they come, there's two players on that side, and it's just a read. They know exactly what they're trying to do because they've rehearsed that. And so I think when you break the game down, rather than just working on your 5v5 zone and working on your man in 5v5 shell and working on your press 5v5, I always just try to find ways that we could break it down into simpler tasks. And I think that's even more true with players without experience, and even more true as you go down in basketball training age and you get into that 7th and 8th grade, 12, 13-year-old kid.
Let's go back to the warm-up then. And warm-ups are very talked about thing now, whether it's dynamic versus static versus, you know, should you do, you know, an hour? Should you do 10 minutes? Should you skip it? There's so many different ways. What do you feel like is the best warm-up for your teams and for basketball in general right now?
So I think you have to look first at the game and what is necessary. What are the demands of the game from a movement quality? And then you have to try to address those at a joint by joint level, if you can, through the warmup. What are the specific movements and even loads that those joints may see? And if we don't prep that prior to the activity, then we're taking a chance when we get into the game. that joint is not going to be ready, or the body is not going to be ready for that movement. So the six load vectors, I think, is what most commonly it'd be referred to with top speed sprinting, horizontal jumping, horizontal acceleration, vertical jumping, back pedaling, twisting. All of those six different load vectors, I think if you can address those in your warm-up and you're dealing with what I call athletes, and I know I had a tweet asking about identifying athletes with KPIs the other day, and people freaked out because athletes don't all look the same, and I understand that. But if you're performing an athletic movement, or if there's movement involved in your sport, complex movement, if you'll just start with the load vectors and build your warm-up based on what you see in your activity, and make sure you're moving in multiple planes, I think you can make and create a successful warm-up for your program.
I'm just going back to my warm-up in kind of middle school, early high school basketball. It was typically stack stretching. It was layup lines. It was, you know, shoot a jumper from the elbow. And then we got into some decision-making, kind of like 3-on-2, 2-on-1 scenarios. But when you mentioned those load vectors, I don't remember sprinting with max intent. I don't remember jumping with max intent. I don't remember bounding or getting into all those different positions that really are going to apply to the game you're going to play. And instead kind of going through this traditional motion of, you know, let's just go through our layup lines. Let's just get warmed up, per se, air quotes there. Mm-hmm. And I think you can really take a different approach and not spend as much, even make it quicker for kids and get them more prepared for the movement demands they're going to have in the game coming up.
Absolutely. The specific demand is what you should be looking at. And this idea of the typical warm-up that our body temp just raises and we're prepared is just totally disproven at this point. But yeah, definitely, if you're starting on a really foundational level, move forward, move backwards, move sideways. Give variations of twist and rotation as you do those movements. Start there and then think about, yeah, the intent and those load vectors. I think that's a great place to start. A controversial thing, I think, because of my influence as a track coach and Tony Holler, really, in part, you know, is that we have not conditioned once. We are not good enough basketball players to have time in our practice to condition if we wanted to, right? We have so many skills. When you only have 26 kids come out and that's what you get, you got to maximize time. We practice on Saturdays. We practice 3 weeks over the break. I mean, we're maximizing everything we can at the middle school level to try to get a win or to score a bucket. But we have not conditioned. I think every now and then, through a competition, I'll six push-ups if you lost by six shots in a shooting comp, or down and back in 11 seconds and we're done. And that's just a quick to give some leverage to a competition and some meaning. But outside of that, we've never, and this is going back 4 years ago, man, we ran Sweet 16s in 60 seconds, 55 seconds. If you can't get across in 16, we're running again. That's asinine. That's me. Why does my fat kid have to run again? Because he couldn't make it. Is he going to make it after he's fatigued and he has to go again? It's not going to happen. There were kids that weren't giving intent and didn't try, and that's rare. But your average kid, and this, I see this in youth sports all the time. I've watched youth football practices, kid not execute skill, big youth kid. Go run the hill, come back, let's do it again. Well, you think he's going to replicate the skill again? No, he's exhausted. You just made his big body run up an enormous hill. So, yeah, we don't condition in that way. But when we do warm up, we do accelerate. We do back pedal. We do things. We do lateral low slides, lateral high slides. We do things that in shorter bursts prepare us for the movements of the game. Skier jumps, backward skier jumps. I know Bobby Stroop's talked about being able to do things, whatever the locomotion skill is, being able to do it forward, backwards, and sideways, again, is kind of a good start. You can take all of your simple movements. If you're a high knee person, take your kid and make him do a backwards high knee, make him do a lateral high knee. Just give him these exposures to other movements and get him out of that basic sagittal plane that we all get stuck in the weight room and in training, and just expose them to different movements. The brain, from my perspective, really likes that. Those nuanced movements it doesn't see, and it challenges it. And that just, from my perspective, a light bulb just brightly shines when we give it those different things that it seeks, those differences.
I want to stick on this conditioning point, because 5 years ago, I would have thought, well, your teams can't be that very good. You must get run out of the gym in the fourth quarter. You're doing a lot, but you're not doing enough because you need to condition. Do you not condition in season, or all year round you don't have conditioning plans for your athletes? And on top of that, do you notice a decrease in performance of your team compared to the other team in the fourth quarter? Or an increase, I should say, too.
So I'm just responsible in season for my seventh and eighth graders.
Gotcha, yep.
And this year we have not conditioned. We also play six-minute quarters, and I have five timeouts. I've never looked out there and said, this year, you got to realize that I'm coming from a place where this is the first time in my life in a basketball season I have not spent a minute of practice on conditioning. Zero. I have not looked out there, though we do not win games because we are not super talented. I have never looked out there and said, man, we are gassed. This is why we're losing. They're getting transition buckets over and over. I've never looked out there and said that. Until this last opponent that we played for a third time, we played man-to-man because that's the skill that's going to develop them the best for high school. We did play a zone this last game. So I guess my point is, it's not as if we're playing slow down, flex offense, and then we chase back into a 2-3 zone and sit there and take a nap and and beat by 30. Like, we're doing everything we can to win games. We're pressing full court, man-to-man. We're running and jumping. We're doing different things like that. And I play eight guys. I've never looked out there and said, man, I think if we were just a little better in shape, we'd have won this game. That's not my thought when I leave the game. It's like, okay, we didn't execute this. We hadn't worked on this skill in a while, and I didn't ever see it in the game. And we're only as good as what we worked on recently. And that's where my mind goes. Not like, oh man, we were getting beat up and down. It just hasn't happened. And again, 6 minute quarters is a difference. But I think when guys, if you can get guys up and down, you can get the conditioning, quote unquote, you can get the conditioning through the game. And that's where I think the shift has been monumentally for people. I think a lot sparked by Tony has just been the demands of the game is what's going to prepare them. Like, what happens in the game prepares them the most for the game. And what we do should supplement that, not fatigue and make it worse and make it miserable for kids too.
The trade-off I see a lot with coaches is when they take away their conditioning, they get increased energy throughout the season. And they also get a decrease in injuries. So you have more kids available throughout the year. They have more energy because they have all these other stressors in their life, and they're just focused on skill development, speed, vertical jump. They're really focused on things that make you a really good basketball player. And they're not dreading the last 10 minutes of practice when you're going to run them into the ground. Have you seen that with your teams? Decrease in injury and increased energy?
For sure, yeah. And I think another aspect of that system of a feed the cat style approach, just mentally, you know, I think people instantly turn off podcasts when they hear Tony Holler or Feed the Cat sometimes because people think that it's a copy and paste system. And I don't think it has to be. I know he inspires me just like other people inspire me with thoughts and ideas. And so, no, we have not seen injury. Usually by this time we've had some sort of an ankle issue or a knee. We've had somebody miss a game, and I won't correlate that directly to a lack of conditioning, but this season we haven't had that issue. We have less kids in our lineup too. The other thing, which could be a stretch, but we haven't had anybody go out with COVID. I mean, we could just be purely lucky. Our top 16 kids, A and B, that practice in the same gym every day with the same two coaches, we haven't had anybody miss for illness or sickness. So there's a lot of things, but yeah, the enjoyment is the biggest, right? And with intent, if you're asking for game speed, you know, at all times, you're not, it's not possible. It's just not possible. And so, for example, I have 8 kids on my team. So, well, let's say we're in a 4v4 shell situation. This is an exact example from the other day. We had, this is the things we wanted to accomplish. Regular man-to-man help gap ball shell. Then we penetrate gaps, help and recover. Then we throw and down screen and work on help and pushing a guy through. So there's all these specific skills. There was 4 different things that we worked on with shell that day. And I think it ended with the 5th round was live. If I have 4-on-4 and I have nobody, because A and B, we kind of practice on separate sides.
Right.
If I flip offense and defense, and then I, you know, it 30 seconds later, we flip again. And I ask you to go as hard as you can there. It's just not necessarily possible, especially when that's not the first thing in your practice.
Mm-hmm.
So what I've even more again in it as an adapted as a coach because of the demands that are placed in front of me, I will be upfront and honest with the kid and say, hey, on this first one with basic, where are you supposed to be, gap man ball or help? I'll just say, hey, I want you to go 50% speed. I just want you to get to the spots and talk. So talking doesn't take a bunch of energy. We're working on a specific skill that we need, but we're not exerting as much energy. Help and recover, 70% effort. I really want you to work hard on the help and recover, but when you're in 3 passes away or you're not in the gap that's being driven, I can expect 50% effort, loud talking. So I'm still giving them something to focus on, but it's not burning the candle, as I like to think of the nervous system, or a glass of orange juice. I'm not just dumping orange juice out. One thing about 7th and 8th grade, we're stuck to a certain schedule of time. I have an hour and 45 minutes, usually closer to 2 every day, because we have a late bus transportation system.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of forced into that 2 hours, hour 45, whether I think it's best or not. So I have to be creative in the amount of energy I demand at what times and what's important, what needs the most execution that day. Because if I need skill or something's new, it needs to be towards the front end of practice, where kids are most engaged, you know, and most able to engage with what you're doing, instead of at the end after, like you said. And then you can go to conditioning at the end after a practice for an hour and 45, and then we have a banged up system already. We've demanded a ton of, and then we throw it into a really stressful conditioning session. That's why injuries happen. If you just really look at it from a grand scheme of things, it just doesn't make sense sometimes the way we do stuff. So,
for sure. And even going back to that injury point, if you're running 4-on-4 drills and you have 8 kids and 1 kid's hurt, well, now it's 4-on-3, or like a coach has stepped in, yeah, or you got to do 3-on-3, you know, it, one injury really makes a difference. And just going back to my football career, I played 4 years of football. 9th grade, I played. 10th grade, I broke my foot, was out the whole year. Junior year, I played, no major injuries, our whole team. Senior year, our quarterback tore his ACL. So 50% of my football playing career was majorly affected by an injury, either to me or to a teammate. So one injury can make a huge difference, especially if it's to that kid. You know, if they're in 8th grade and they've never played basketball and they really want to play in high school, 8th grade is a big year for them. So doing anything you can. And I'm guessing none of the kids miss any of the conditioning drills that you've done in the past, or that their friends do, or that other teams do. You know, it's not like these kids are dying to run gassers or run killers or run, what you call them, sweet 16s?
Yeah, sweet 16s, elite 8s. We'd break it down across court that way. Line drills, championship drills, 2 line drills and a down and back, or a line drill and 2 down and backs in a certain amount of time. Like, I've got every conditioning basketball drill you can think of in my head that I did myself, or I as a player, or I did as a coach for my first few years. And again, there's aspects of this idea of toughness and things that you can get through other methods than just repeated sprint ability. Toughness isn't a task. I don't know who said that on a recent podcast, but a Marine and a surgeon are both tough. You take them out of their environment and you put them in the other environment, they're not as tough anymore. It's 2 different types of toughness. And so toughness isn't a task, and you can develop toughness in a variety of ways rather than physically punishing someone through repetitions of non-specific energy system and conditioning to that sport. So absolutely, going to your point, maybe we can transition into some of the protection type things I use for high school kids. But I know Brad Dixon, again, I'm going through the TFC who's who here, but Brad Dixon talks about being at a really small school. We're 1,400 students. 20% of our students will play sports. So we're actually only about 300 kids in our school, quick math, but 250 to 300 kids in our school that will participate in any sport. So we're not that much different than a small school. But Brad talks about how he only has so many guys. If he loses a guy, you know, that's what bought him into the RPR system and some of those other things, was just, I can't afford to lose a guy. And we are no different. If we lost one of our best varsity boys players, and we've struggled the last few games since he had an ankle injury, freaky looking ankle injury, and he'll be back. But you know, you just can't. I don't think many places, you know, we can hypothetically say in Texas football, you got all these guys like next guy up, you know, or Alabama football if you want to look at the collegiate level. But really, If your best player, if one of your starters or best players goes out, it makes an impact whether or not you have a bevy of talent beneath or not. That there's a reason that guy was starting and you chose him to be a player for you. So we use a ton of stuff, man. This is where I'm getting really excited with all the different methods that I have, I think, in targeting the brain and some of the assessment stuff we've been working on. So
let's dive into that. As a physical therapist, I love not only like rehab, but injury prevention as well, because the more, you know, it's a pound of prevention, or an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of rehab. So whatever we can do to prevent kids from having to go see a PT, having to go to rehab, having to have surgery, having to miss games is absolutely crucial. And that's why I bought into RPR so much, just from using it on myself, talking to other coaches, seeing their success with it. Cal Dietz here at the U, he uses it. He's the founder of it, or one of the co-founders, I should say. So talk to me about those protective systems that you have used and integrated and adapted and adopted and used with your kids, because we need to learn that stuff.
For sure. So some of my go-to systems, I guess, on a holistic level, the acronyms, all of the acronyms here. So we got RPR system, reflexive performance reset. Total motion release is a physical therapy concept. I think it applies to some other ones. Functional range conditioning with your cars. And I don't use pails and rails, but cars, just controlled articular rotations. And then some ideas that I'm diving into now with based on the Postural Restoration Institute with Connor Harris's program. All of those things, I think, kind of shape the way I look at it. RPR, I had a good conversation on Twitter the other day, or actually with a student. He said, "Coach, how do you know all this stuff about the brain? Where did you learn that?" And I paused and I just said, I think it all started with RPR. You know, prior to RPR, I had no understanding or connection from the neuromuscular side of things. I didn't see how the brain connected at all. It was all black and white, X's and O's. This is what I've done. This is why I'm always going to do it. This is the way I was coached. This is the way I'm going to coach. And RPR level one in Illinois, Decatur, Illinois, drove up there. Me and my fiance at that time got a hotel. We like treated as a vacation. went to level one, was not super confident coming back, did not implement it immediately. Hosted a level one and level two here at my school. Chris Corfus came down and did it. Chris did not do the first one I went to, but Chris came back. So then I've been to a level one where I met a lot of people, and then coming back here and hosting one, got to meet a lot of people, level one and two. And then I got to go through it again, level two for the first time. And I actually ended up hosting a second one with Chris Corfus again, level one and level two. And so as a non understander or believer, whichever way you want to look at it, of that brain system, I think the more repetition I got in looking at RPR, what it was doing with the connection from some, I always write down a lot of notes and then go back and look. And so looking at the spots that RPR developed from, and again, with names, I sometimes struggle, but going back to the 1820s and those spots that scientists looked at and how those connected straight to the RPR system, I immediately dive into those sort of things and go into those. So anyway, early on, I think for anyone that's just learning about things, I think there is a level of comfort you must have with yourself and understanding the why before you're willing to share. I think it's dangerous to run back with something you hear for the first time and then try to implement it right away. And right. So for me, it took so many trials of RPR. I mean, I still have every note from RPR. It's funny how my brain thought differently, like what I heard the first time, and then I had heard it. So the second time I could think about how to apply it. And so for me, when I think of these systems, it's not just take the system for what it is, and again, cut and paste. But when I think of the system, how can I directly apply it to whatever I coach or who I coach to benefit their performance? And so RPR, it just depends for me in my different roles as track and field coach, strength and conditioning coach, physical education coach, and middle school basketball coach. Each one of those settings, I use a different variety. I do not use the same stuff. I don't feel as comfortable using the same stuff in every different setting. With our track program, I would say we use the most. We use almost everything. Middle school kids, I've used RPR with my middle school cross country team. I've coached 2 years of middle school cross country. I don't use it with my basketball team. There's just different groups of people and scenarios where certain things would go and certain things wouldn't, or certain, like, spend a while teaching my middle school basketball team about why for RPR when I first meet them or get to a lot of skill development. So it's not as if it's a cut and dried 100% here and there, but I've always viewed systems and skills and neural things that I learn or listen to people, whether it's benefits of ISOs neuromuscularly or any concept I take from somebody, I'm always just trying to build a toolbox. And I think people that are in positions like me, I think they get really comfortable with what they know and the position that they have, and they do a good job and it's just good enough. And they don't, for whatever reason, I have this interest in just continually learning more and more and more. And then, because if I run across a kid, let's say with an injury, because I do serve in some evaluation settings as a strength conditioning coach, and I feel that's appropriate. So if I get a kid and I evaluate the systems that I know, let's say RPR level 2, I assess hip flexion, hip extension, and I'm unable to find a solution, I'm stuck. I can't help that kid. And that bothers me. So then I investigate into more systems, and then I can help that kid. And so it just, like, I try to prepare myself for every situation, injury situation, recovery, coming back from an injury situation, coming into the weight room, restrictions in mobility. How can I target that? Restrictions in movement quality. How can I affect that? So I just try to build this enormous toolbox, and it never ends. It's continual. It's why I do things like this. It's why I like talking to people and listening to podcasts like this, is because taking a couple things out of that and applying it to my system, I'm better. And that's what I'm constantly searching for. I'm not searching for a one fix all sort of thing. I'm looking for a little piece from each one. How do they connect? How can I use them? And definitely, I'm really rambling, but I like to stack variables. So I stack RPR prior to a controlled articular rotation. I feel neuromuscularly getting that activation, brain connect to certain muscles, and then exposing the joint through the full range of motion. When I use ISOs, I stack the eyes, the jaw, the vestibular system, I stack all those things on top of each other, and then I get that big bang for buck. Where if I only knew ISO, overcoming right. yielding, then I wouldn't be able to use them. So I use them in potentiation of other things, I guess, is another way to look at them. But I like to stack variables, and I think that just comes from being a good coach. Stacking is like the same thing as like building skill, whether I'm teaching a discus thrower or a master level skill. Just stacking all those variables and putting them together, it's very similar. So it's always been something that's made sense to me.
You mentioned mobility hacks kind of with basketball players. Which one specifically do you see the most for basketball players? How players struggle with mobility and certain drawings or certain movements? And what have you done to help that the most?
Sure. So I think everything starts from the ground up with basketball. Mm-hmm. And so starting at the ankle, I think most kids lack dorsiflexion. Stuff I've stolen that's simple. You could add these mobility. I've always thought these are simple mobility adds prior to a warm-up or an activity. And so I will give you some ideas here and say things, and I'm not always the best at exactly why it works, but I can just tell you it works. And at some point I pick up the reason why and I can connect it.
Right.
But for the ankle, we'll take the right ankle and we will use the opposite wrist and shoulder to potentiate and open up ranges in the opposite ankle. So opposite wrist and opposite ankle are connected. I have no idea why. I've seen it and tried it. So you can set up in a traditional, let's say you're in a kneeling position and you're going to take toes are just a few inches from the wall and you're going to drive the shin forward and press the knee to the wall.
Mm-hmm, sure.
A pretty classic mobility exercise.
Right.
And you could do that over and over and over every day. You could add a band around the ankle. You could do whatever you want to like make it more difficult. Or you could just do like a brain hack and get that mobility right away. And so opposite wrist, flexion and extension. And then we actually cork the arm all the way into what I would classify as internal rotation or external rotation. So there's four options that I'll do with a kid. And one of them will unlock some additional range. So internal rotation, flexion, internal rotation, wrist extension, external rotation of the shoulder, arm straight, and then internal rotation. Rotation with flexion and extension of the wrist. And I look for whatever makes the most impact. Well, how do I test that? I do that really basic mobility thing that people do. And I just see what makes the most impact. Where can I move my toes back farther with whichever arm movement to get that? The other thing from a flexion, global extension or global release of flexion that we use is just palm of your hand to your forehead in a forward flex position, kind of like an overcoming isometric. So I'm just pressing my forehead right. into the palm of my head and I unlock flexion. Again, we want to test that. We could do the same ankle dorsiflexion activity. For that, I just use most of the time touching your toes. For a majority of kids, forehead, palm, flexion activity, I think because of proximity to the brain, it really activates those connections. We can go from not touching our toes. We spend 5 seconds in an overcoming ISO with the palm of our hand and our forehead. And next thing I know, I'm able to flex my hip even farther and touch my toes. And it's the same concept up and down the chain in any joint that flexes. So I'm not a PT or an ATC or anything like that, but I think of things in a joint by joint approach. So if I'm missing flexion, I think about how can I potentiate flexion? The other way to potentiate flexion, I think that's really simple that everyone should do, is using their eye movements. So Dan Fichter talks a lot about eye saccades. I just do really basic eye movements right now. So if I want flexion, I go eyes up with a neutral head. If I want extension potentiation, I go eyes down with a neutral head. It's not about the head. You know, you think about back squatting, how many people looked up with their head and how bad that was on their neck. But I think they were onto something, right? They were like figuring something out neurologically that people right. didn't understand because those eyes were all the way up. So I'll take those simple, quick hacks such as those to potentiate flexion. So if they lack dorsiflexion, I'll use those activities. Let's say head press takes 5 seconds. And then as I'm doing my mobility exercises, I'm locked eyes to the ceiling and I'm actually getting more additional range of motion. So if you think about it from like the philosophy of FRC, expose the joint to a full 360 degree, if it can, idea of this exposure to the range so that when it goes there, it doesn't get injured. Like if you've never been somewhere
right
at a joint level and you go there, that's where your risk of injury is. That's their philosophy. Mm-hmm. So for me to potentiate additional ranges and then still do those classic mobility exercises, it's like, why wouldn't I add those simple things? And so ankle for sure. Knee stability would be the next thing up the chain that I would move to. And for that, we spend a lot of time on a single leg, and we can talk about the off season stuff if we have time today, and kind of the weekly look at that. But I think of knee stability and hip stability being anytime I can get them on a single leg and challenge coordination, I'm building stability through those two places. And so, but again, if we have a limitation at the hip, we can use total motion release, which is kind of a Sherrington's law, I believe, is where that would come from. When you're looking at good side versus bad side and the brain left and right hemisphere, how it uses the good sided mobility of one side and then will free open some additional ranges on the bad side. So we'll do hip flexion, hip extension, total motion release if we feel that's going to benefit us additionally from those other things too. So I use TMR on ground-based activity days for weight room just to open up those ranges too. And again, total motion release for me, I just learned through online YouTube videos, mm-hmm. and just taking those concepts of Sherrington's laws and then trying to apply them and test and retest and test and retest. It's just all about finding a comfort level. You can't just listen to a podcast and then go out and execute it, right? It takes so much practice. Right. I always have to start on myself or my wife, which she absolutely hates when I try to do voodoo neural things. Why are you? Well, that hurts so bad. Why are you doing that? I'm like, okay, fine. You really aren't interested in feeling any better when your lat's tight or your shoulder's tight or your neck's tight. But yeah, one more really fun one I think everyone should be using
for sure
from a reflex standpoint. And I don't know if it's a stumble reflex, but we'll do a truss fall. And the way that potentiates, I think, flexion and extension is crazy from the vestibular system. So we will literally, if a kid's not comfortable, right, falling into the arms of a peer. And that's the thing about my systems. I don't like finding things where it's hands-on. I really don't. Me putting my palms in my head, me using my eyes, those are all things as an athlete I can choose to do and feel comfortable with. But the more we start touching others and making them touch certain things, I think you get into a gray area in public settings. I think private setting might be a little different. But so anyway, most of my stuff is all can be user-friendly in that situation, and it just blows people's minds. But saw Dan use the startle or stumble reflex with a falling sensation. And so in the gym with those pads on the baseline, I'll have kids stand there and just cross their arms and just fall backwards until their shoulders roll into that wall. And again, we just use pre and post test as toe touch. Well, what if the kid can already touch their toes? Well, there's a possibility they're going to get additional ranges still that they can see, right. If they were fingers to toes and now they're full hand on the ground, that's significant. Mm-hmm. And I know that's just one outcome that we're visually seeing, but I think as a high school teacher, that's a really quick way to see, but it's amazing how in my PE class, we'll go with, we always start with the forehead. You can use the back of the head for extension. We start with that. And our toe touch, if they still can't touch their toes, I make them use their eyes when they're already in that stretch. I say, now throw your eyes up and see if you can get there. And then if they can't, we go to the stumble or startle reflex as we fall back in a truss fall, and then if we can't go from there, we go to breathing drills. We try to diaphragmatically breathe, because what I see is most kids that don't display flexibility They are really jacked up mechanically breathing. That's why they're so locked down and protected. And so then we go to breathing drills. And so we just find ways. Again, I'm jumping all over from basketball to strength training to PE, but that's what kind of makes my job unique is I wear so many hats. But all those things can be applied, I think, pre-practice or in between drills. My older kids that learn all my systems by the time they're a senior, I'll see them belly breathing at the free throw line. I'll see them doing TMR on their own before they get into a squat. Like, that's what I want, is to like build capable people that can make a decision for themselves. Like, did I enjoy this? Did this benefit me? And now I'm going to use it. And that's what's really cool.
The techniques you're using, you're teaching them how to fish instead of just giving them fish. You're teaching them how to do it on their own. It doesn't take very much time. So any coach who's listening to this and it's like, why are we doing all this stuff? Like, this doesn't make any sense. I don't understand. Like, it takes 5 seconds to put your hand to your forehead, press into it, and see if that unlocks something. If it works, great. If it doesn't, you move on to the next thing. But just the risk-reward factor, the risk is so minimal. Why wouldn't you try it? Try it with your kids. Do it for a couple of weeks. See if you get anything from that. And then you can always go back and try to learn the mechanism behind it. When you use these techniques, do you see a lot of carryover week to week, season to season? Or is it something every day we kind of have to unlock these kids, do these techniques, and then get them going?
For sure. That's a great question. So that's where most people they go to, I think, is like, how long does it last? That's a test and retest situation. I'll tell you this. I've tested it as much as I can. I always ask questions. So just most recently, PE, first day, everyone got to touch their toes. Many kids had never touched their toes. Like, it's just a impactful thing. Like, because like, touch your toes, you need to stretch more. Like, we've been yelled at for years. Like, why can't you touch your toes? You need to stretch. And like, to get someone there in a matter of seconds is just instant buy-in. It really is. But anyway,
I'm gonna interrupt you quick here. Yeah, do you remember in PE growing up, you had like the toe touch, like it was like a fitness, standard or a measure, the wall touch test or whatever it was.
Yeah. Sit and reach. It's still
sit and reach. There we go. Thank you.
Still a test. Yep.
But it's like, if your arms are disproportionately long compared to your legs, you're automatically going to do better. Like, it doesn't even measure flexibility from that standpoint. And then if you're all neurally jacked up, you're going to do porn in every single year and you don't even know why you're doing bad on it. So that was me. My arms aren't very long, and I think I've been kind of narrowly compressed and flexed and tight my whole life, and I've just started to learn how to undo all of that. So go ahead. Sorry to interrupt you there.
No, that's all right. Yeah, it's the fitness gram testing is just a display of general fitness. I mean, they're missing so many things, I think.
Right.
There's a lot of classic testing that does, but sit and reach, yeah, totally insane. Like, just give me an elementary PE class one day and I'll have fun with these little kids. Like, you know, like, hey, fall back on this mat, and then, hey, press your head into your hand or to the wall. And they would just think it's awesome. Okay, come do the sit and reach. Oh my gosh, you know. Yeah. So anyway.
I needed you in like third grade. So
yeah, exactly. And that's like, so I'm going to try to put together a resource at a really low cost. I don't know, just whatever's worth it for my time. I want to create a video explanation of a guy who took these systems or these ideas from people and then how I adapt it and how I use it and how teach it. I always tell kids, like, do you need, if you have a little brother or sister, like, is that baby, if you were to like take its arm and like move it, would it just move all the way through the range of motion, or is it like limited? And like, for the most part, babies are like super pliable and like stretchy. And I'm like, well, that's how we all started, right? Like, we were all like that. And then something happened that caused us to compensate. And that's why we're locked down. It's not, you're not a bad person, man. We just got to like find out how to do that. So anyway, so with PE, they come back the next day, they'd all touch their toes, and we're actually on block schedule. So this was 48 hours later. All right, try to touch your toes again. Almost all the kids that could not again. So they resorted back. If you think about the things that cause compensations, just on a whole scale idea, those compensations, well, let's say it's breathing. So if breathing is your compensation and your dysfunction, and you're taking 20,000 repetitions a day or more, mm-hmm. you know, I've just heard the number 20,000. So if you're using 20,000 a day and I shift it for 2 minutes and I get this really big output, and then you revert back to what you've done for repetition after repetition after repetition, it's going to be really hard to shift that long-term unless you make that commitment over time. So they come back, they're not touching their toes. Well, does that make my system bad that it didn't last 48 hours? Or is it okay that we just do those potentiation activities again and it takes less than a minute of our class time and we're ready to stretch? We've potentiated their range of motion right back. So there's that. There's that example. I've also tested with cross-country middle school kids flexibility hacks. Send them out for the workout, come back in. Can you still touch your toes? The kids that couldn't were still touching their toes. And that was a pretty hard workout. So I've always thought of the most common reason why you revert back to your limits is from the repetition or that fight or flight response, that stress that reverts you back into that situation. But in this particular example of the cross country kids, they went out on a hard run and came back. And, you know, that's what I think is the most important part of coaching and applying systems, is asking questions. Because if you don't, and you just assume, it becomes really hard to associate certain qualities. And so I just, for whatever reason, I try as much as possible to follow up. Let's say in PE, we start with that. And at the end of PE class, after we played, you know, I don't know, dodgeball, and then I'm going to retest it. Did the stress of like almost getting killed in the face with a dodgeball revert me back to my inflexible ways, or was I able to withstand it a little bit longer? And the end all be all answer is that it just depends based on that person's brain. We are all unique, mm-hmm. Up top. And so I think for every person, it's a little different. And again, it just comes down to time and risk reward, like you said, and the ability for me to execute it really quickly just makes it a why wouldn't you thing. So, and kids think it's fun. I mean, all those things are kind of fun. So
do you use a lot of these techniques more in the off season when you have more time and less pressure from preparing for a game, things like that? Or what are your main goals, philosophy with off season training?
Yeah. So off season training, it's kind of unique too. So I'm working with high school age population in the off season. So in the summer, very general preparation, I would say, more than anything, in terms of the movements, very basic, not as complex. They're playing a lot more games. We do have more time in the summer. There's no doubt about it. They get a lot of those specific demands from the game. They play a lot of games in the summer, man. And my job's like preserve and maintain while trying to build some good qualities. Then in our kind of our off season, a couple weeks into the school year through the dead week before the winter sports, it ends up being about 8 weeks. There's not as much play, and I become the primary movement skill guy. Mm-hmm. And so that's where we spend, much more time, with that. But in the off season, I get them for about 45 minutes, during the fall off season, I get them for about 45 minutes because I have coached another sport at the middle school level, which was cross country. So we are extremely efficient and purposeful in what we choose to do. And I guess in just kind of a thematic idea, because I know this was one of the main goals and some requests of some people was wanting to know kind of the way we structured that and how it's a little different. We look at hitting those load vectors and we look at triplanar movement still in the same way we would for the warm-up, just in a much more complex kind of ideology in the way that mm-hmm. we build that in. And I look at it from a, so I go Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday off, Thursday, Friday, and we're still in the fall here. I don't want to get too off track, but we look at like a high-low model, if you will. So I never try to train athletes in a upper lower, especially in the weight room. I don't do upper lower split, like a 4 day split.
Right.
But I literally look at opposite actions, am I hitting all of the planes in this particular workout? Mm-hmm. It makes it really easy when you're on block schedule. But even going back to when we were a modified block prior to COVID, I still now look at things that way rather than, hey, today is chest and back and we're coming back legs, you know, like I think a lot of people still flow that way. Especially with athletes, I never try to train it in a sense of that. Again, I'm just looking at the way they move, what they specifically need, and are they moving through those planes at each joint level, and how do I potentiate and set up the skill of doing that? Like, how do I build that lateral chain to be able to change directions and move and those sort of things? So for us, there's more of a high-low model, but we do, because of the amount of contacts and the complexity of our jumps and plyos, we do more dynamic activity on Monday, Thursday, and more static stability activity on Tuesday, Friday. And sometimes that does appear to be lower upper because of the amount of volume spent.
Right.
But that's not the progression that we use. So when I first started this off season stuff, all I thought about for sure was my emphasis, how it's changed. I always thought you build the ability to guard based on just that frontal plane straight line movement. And I think I've seen and done less and less of just straight left and right movement. Like if you watch the game of basketball, and again, I heard someone the other day talk, really made a lot of sense to me. It was Stephen Jones. He looks at the game of cricket from the attractors and like top down approach of what's actually occurring. And mm-hmm. then he builds his training based on that. And that's the same way that I've approached it. So on that Monday, we're doing a lot of change of direction, plyos in all different ranges. We do a variety of to build some force absorption qualities that I think are overlooked too a lot in basketball training. We do a lot of what I would call a snap down series that we progress beyond just up and down jumps. So we build it from a foundation of load and jump, land safely, and then we progress it into frontal plane, transverse movements, single leg, double leg, repeated jump abilities. So I just start at that foundational level. I'm torn between whether I say I start bilateral and work unilateral, or if I start unilateral, has more transition to bilateral. I'm really closer there, but I still can't give up like that foundational movement quality on two seems to be a better place to start for me than one. But then we definitely progress to single. And so I guess in a progression way too, just the way my brain thinks, and this is why I like podcasts, because you really have to think about why you do it. But I progress also in a planar motion. So within a given session, sagittal plane, frontal plane, and transverse. And that's how I progress the complexity of the movements throughout the session. So that would be like a typical Monday. So like lots of variety of jumps. There could be some hand-eye coordination and challenge of the system through those jumping activities. It's just not all jumping for 45 minutes. And then Tuesday we come back and we hit like position. This somehow I came up with this before I even heard people talk about it, was like position specific isometrics. We were doing that with medicine balls. And from a stability standpoint, we were talking about like the ability to stabilize when we're being bumped in different ways, or when someone's bumping a medicine ball in that triple threat position or the overhead rebound position or whatever. We were doing some of those things that I think talking and hearing more and more people talk about ISOs and how that works, that's what we've been doing. And it makes a lot of sense to me. I've always thought like that's a specific skill from the game. Can we be strong in that position so that when we encounter it, the ball doesn't get ripped out of our hands mm-hmm. or, you know, those type of things. So that's kind of the way that we build the week from a Monday through Friday standpoint. We definitely work on sprint mechanics as well. And that kind of idea of, like, if you just think about basic things like boom booms or switches, like those actions of movement qualities are good plyometrics as well. And so we do that towards the end of the week. But we just compete and try to expose them to a lot of different movement qualities and challenge them to seek and experience new movements and think about the way that they're landing. And because it's just so unpredictable, if you watch the game of basketball, like it's not what you think. It's still not what I think. Like, I still have to watch so much more because people just aren't watching the right things when they watch the game.
What do your athletes report is the biggest takeaway they get out of the off-season training program?
Yeah, so I think the focus has always been defensively, because and agility, really, like change of direction. Agility is an overused term, but the change of direction aspect, like becoming a better athlete is what it really comes down to. And again, maybe that's an overused term, but I think athletes can move really, really well and change directions. And anything you throw at an athlete, they can do. And so building that resiliency is what the athletes get out of it. And that's why they come. And I think they see the level of thought that I put into it. And I talk about how I believe this would transfer to the game. And that's what we're trying to get out of it. I don't think in a basketball practice, and I haven't seen, people don't work on specific skills like change of direction, lateral cutting. That's not a part of their practice. It's a byproduct of the game of basketball.
Mm-hmm.
But if that's the first time a freshman is experiencing that movement, to me, that's dangerous. And they're not super successful and confident at it. So I've always taken pride in what I do, being able to transfer to two really important skills, like my ability to defend and move and all these different movements, reacting to an offensive player. And then also my ability to be quick in my decision and my first step as an offensive player. So like to put myself in all these different positions, we spend a lot of time in split positions too, because what I started to see was so much of basketball is in a split. And so like, I guess when I watch a game of basketball, I don't watch the ball. It's hard. It's hard as a fan of a sport. We get caught in watching, you know, James Harden when he has the ball and what he's doing, but we miss the other four players. We don't watch the defense. We don't watch the way that the other people move. And you'll pick up the most from watching players off the ball and how they move. And you won't see it often in even real time. It's almost important to take clips and slow them down
right,
to really see what's going on. It really is ever changing for me, and continuing to find new ways to challenge that coordination and that system to prepare it for the demands it's going to see in the season. I want those kids to go into that basketball practice and nothing our head basketball coach throws at them, they can't perform from a movement quality standpoint. That's my number one goal. And they're super strong within positions that are important for the game, but they don't have to be super strong. What classically people would classify, they don't have 300 pound squats and 200 pound benches, but they're really strong in those positions.
We should have started the podcast with that. That was just a little great segment there. I know your coaching is translating to your athlete success, because I've seen the results you have posted on Twitter. Especially I think lately you posted some of your track highlights of the last, you know, 3 to 4 years. And I hope the information from this podcast translate to all the coaches out there who are trying to beef up their system to get better basketball players, to have better cultures, to have better programs. You can see more of Tyler and I. We kind of go back and forth on Twitter a little bit. So you can see our interactions there. You can follow him at Coach Rathke. There's underscore in there in between Coach and Rathke on Twitter. That link will be in the show notes. Thank you, Tyler, for hopping on the Bold Base Reforms podcast. We had a really great chat with you, and I'm excited to see all the different information and clinics and resources you put out in the future.
Absolutely. I really appreciate having me on, and I'll make sure to share to some of the presentations I've done on this specific topic. I don't know if you can put a presentation in the show notes, but I'll be happy to share a link on my Selfie page if you can't get it in the show notes, for people to kind of see some videos and some different things to spark some ideas. Because I know just voices is sometimes hard to perceive, and I hate that about that, but I want to give people the opportunity to see some of the things that we do too. And that's a way on Twitter to see that as well, but definitely we'll share some resources that I have.
Perfect. The learning never stops. Let's continue to grow the mind and change the system.